they gave me that to pick up the dead guys and move them to, we reburied a lot of them on Okinawa. They put temporary, because they couldn't process them all fast enough, so they'd line them up, the dead guys, then they'd dump dirt on them, then they'd make another line and put them in there just temporary. So then they redig them, process them to ship them back to the United States.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 27. And we have a special privilege this week. We have not only a World War II veteran himself, but we have his bride. And the two interviewees this week are Paul and June Beneschek from Anamosa, Iowa. And June is 91. Paul is 93. So he married a younger woman. But we're so excited to talk to both of them and just a little background on kind of how this came together. So Paul actually arrived, he joined the Army sort of right in the final days of World War II, and he actually deployed after the war had ended, after Japan surrendered. Still considered a World War II veteran, he deployed over to the Pacific Theater, specifically Okinawa, and his job, his very difficult job, was to go through and dig up, so exhume, prepare, treat, and send the dead Americans, American bodies back to the United States. So an extremely difficult job. And it's just, it's unlike any other job or person, that at least that I've spoken to. So just thought it was really interesting, because when we think about all of the things that had to happen during World War II to, you know, properly honor those of the fallen, to send them back, to do all those things, you just sort of take that for granted. But there's all these little processes and steps that had to happen to properly honor the fallen. And by the way, the United States is really the only country that did that and continues to do that today. You know, most countries just bury their dead in large graves there in country. They left them there. But the United States, after the war, gave the families the choice of whether to bury them in theater, in established American cemeteries, or bring them home. And then even nowadays, we have, you know, remains still that we have unidentified, and we dedicate a tremendous number of resources every year as DNA technology improves to continue identifying those remains. And again, we're the only country that does that. And Paul was part of that early on, you know, towards the end of World War II. And of course, Okinawa, there's so many dead on Okinawa, and they were buried all over the island from, you know, as Paul describes, local families that had a plane or whatnot crash near them, and they pulled the body out and buried the body right then and there. And so one of Paul's jobs with he and his team was to go find those bodies, prepare them, and send them back. And of course, very, very, very difficult job. And we'll talk about it a little after the interview and kind of give some perspective on it. But just an absolute honor to meet Paul and his amazing wife, June. They live in a town called Anamosa, Iowa, which is a small town in Iowa, not too far from actually where my family grew up on my mom's side. My mom and grandparents were born and raised in a small town called Clinton, Iowa, which isn't far away. And actually, June happened to work for Clinton Foods, which is a fairly well-known company in that area. And the way this all came to be, we have a gentleman by the name of Rob. He listens to our podcast, and Rob, thank you for listening. And he sent me a note through the website, and he mentioned that he knew Paul and he knew June, and kind of told me a little bit of background on their story and the really interesting story. And then he introduced me to his mom and dad, whose names are Barb and Denny. And so Barb corresponded with her, and she set up this interview, which is really awesome, really an awesome day. And so I drove over to Anamosa, Iowa, and I spent the day and spent some time with Paul and June in their beautiful home. And then Barb and Denny showed me their home, which is amazing. And they're just an amazing family, and they really treated me to a very special day, and I so enjoyed meeting all of them. And just an amazing family, very patriotic. They're so appreciative of our military, and just an honor to meet all of them. So I really want to thank Barb and Denny and Rob for not only for reaching out and for connecting me with June and Paul and arranging all of that, but also for hosting me and just being so awesome. And I look forward to coming back. I told you I'd come back, and look forward to coming back, and can't wait to see you guys again soon. So without further ado, let's talk to June and Paul Beneschek and talk to them about all of those crazy things that happened to get all of our fallen heroes home. So here's Paul and June.
My mom was born and raised in Clinton, Iowa.
Oh, baby.
And
I worked at Clinton Foods.
Oh, did you really? I've only been there one or maybe two times, and that was when we had relatives that passed away, and we would go there. And I was younger, so I don't. But I remember Iowa as being flatter.
Whereas yeah, this down is south is
rolling
very
hills.
Flat.
This is beautiful.
Yeah. Down south is very flat, isn't it, June? Once you get to down to Olin, it's just flatter than heck. But up here,
we live in the hills.
We own the hills, don't we?
It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your childhood, because it's hard. So my background, my grandpa fought in World War II. He also from Clinton, Iowa. Grandparents from Clinton, Iowa.
And then that's where I worked.
We got married in Clinton.
I worked at Clinton. It's not Clinton Foods now, but that's where I worked.
ADM.
I was the billing clerk for the railroad cars that went out of there.
That's amazing.
All numbers. And they got married
1 week after I was born.
Oh, now that I didn't know.
Yeah, remember we talked about that?
Yeah.
I was born on February 11th, and you were married that next week.
Oh.
That's amazing.
It's been a long time.
Then we got married February 4th.
Okay, then you got married a week before I was born.
Yeah.
Well, that makes it better, because otherwise you guys might have had to get married. When you adopt me, you might have to.
And he lived 60 miles. I lived 60 miles away from where
she must have been really worth the
distance. Well, my cousin married his brother, and she was a finagler because she really liked me as a first cousin. So she brought him to my graduation. And I had a boyfriend there.
Ah, I see.
And he said, "Who is that guy?"
He's married. He died now.
Yeah.
Your old boyfriend.
See, it's a good thing you didn't marry him. You'd be all on your own.
That's right.
He was 5 years older than me.
Mm. We was in the cemetery where her brother is buried, and he was right next, buried him right next to her brother.
That's it. So
life is funny.
Yeah.
So you... My grandpa served in World War II, and then my dad was a Marine in Korea and Vietnam, and then I was in these current, you know,
in
Iraq. And so anyway, I have a great appreciation for anybody that ever served in the military, but I love hearing stories from veterans that served, you know, that what you guys did gave us the freedoms that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids that are growing up today don't understand that, and they don't teach it a lot of times in school.
No history
anymore. They don't teach these things. And so my goal is to try to just understand as best I can, you know, what you all went through growing up, and then try to share it with as many people as possible, because they don't teach this stuff anymore.
I
was going to get drafted, so instead of getting drafted, I enlisted, and then I could have re-enlisted and got another stripe. And then I thought, but I had a farm set and waiting for me to farm.
Sure.
So I thought, well, I'm going to get out and start. So I bought the farm before we were married. I had the house. When we got married, we moved right in. She had all the furniture bought, of course. She worked hard. And
I worked at Clinton Foods. I had a good job. I was a billing clerk.
They just raised her raises. They raised them to. She got more than any of the men got. The men, like on the farm, was getting $1 a day, and she was getting more than that
with benefits.
But then I took her out of her job because we got married.
And go to farming, they got less money.
So after you got married, then you moved over to the farm.
Yeah.
And
60 miles where my cousin lived. She was a conniver.
And what was the name of the town again?
Oxford Junction.
Oxford Junction.
Oxford Junction, okay.
And Lost Nation was right next there too, Lost Nation.
I see. And so that's where your cousin lives. That's where your cousin, that's Oxy. Okay. Yeah.
Married my brother.
And she really liked me.
Just think it's amazing that how all that came together. And it's unusual too to hear of a distance relationship, you know. Usually it's at that point, usually it's because they didn't have the internet and all that kind of stuff.
No,
it's always
been a local guy.
Yeah, that's funny. So when you grew up, you were born there in Oxford Junction, I take it.
Yeah.
And
he was.
Yes.
I was born in Cebulo.
Okay.
Down by the river.
Okay, and so you were born there, and what did your family farm as well?
Yeah.
Dairy farm?
Well, just a few cows, milk. The most we milked was, I think, like 14.
I see, okay.
But we milked by hand. We never had a milking machine.
I see.
My brother, when he got married, then he got a milking machine, Raymond, the oldest boy.
They had a lot of children.
And he monkeyed with a milking machine so much that, and then people wanted to buy stuff. So he had to quit farming to sell milking machines. He was in the down at Clinton, and he sold a great big milking parlor to a farmer, and he was busy. But then the milking machine went to hell, and he didn't have no work anymore. So then he had to go back to, I think he went to, Raymond went back to farming or something.
Yeah, and he also had a warehouse in Oxford.
Were they out later?
Yeah, later.
Later, when the guy was selling the hardware store in Oxford Junction. Well, he was selling the milking machines, and when he bought the hardware store to go in with that, of course, then the milking machine business quit. Then he had the hardware store.
And so when you were growing up, like when you went to school, how big were the schools and those sorts of things?
Country at that school. Point?
They were one, a school where my mom went to a similar school.
By myself most of the time.
Okay. So it was just all grades were together.
All 12 grades.
No, 8 grades in country.
Then
they had to go to.
Yeah, then I went to high school.
Town school.
In town.
For high school. Mm-hmm.
So basically all the grades were. My mom went to a similar school growing up.
And Cebulo was the last school to get school buses. So I had a board in town.
Gotcha.
I worked for my room and board.
Interesting.
That's how I got to high school.
And we had a neighbor that, Clark, he drove to town. He was going to high school. Then he had a brother younger that rode with him, of course. So then I'd walk a mile to his place and get to ride with him to go to high school. So.
Did you go clear through high school then, Paul?
No. Dad was kind of ill on the farm, so I quit to farm. Then the superintendent come out to get me so I'd finish that grade. So I finished that grade, and then that was the end of it.
What grade was that?
Ninth grade.
Okay.
So then I quit. But I could have got my diploma if I would have went, I don't know how it was. But I went to school then later after I was in the service, and they said, well, that won't count. You're supposed to go to the school before you went. So I made money and farmed. I didn't need the diploma.
Exactly.
So when you joined the service, did they care that you hadn't,
Well, you just didn't get rank.
I see.
If I had more rank or if
school.
I had more education, I could have got more
I
rank.
See.
But I couldn't hardly have been an officer anyway because I can't remember numbers and names and that. So I wouldn't have been very good.
He didn't care.
And I'm a slow reader. They'd have a test or something, and I'd read the test, and I'd be halfway through, and they'd blow the whistle. time. They'd give you like an hour to do a test. Well, it took me 2 hours.
Well, that's okay. That's okay.
But I got by. Mm-hmm. I made it up, so.
Yeah, look at where we live.
Yeah.
Oh, this
look where they got to.
This is one of the most beautiful views I've ever seen.
I picked this spot out. Long before I would go to Cedar Rapids to shop,
sure.
And I picked this house spot house. I said, that's where I want to live.
Then we walked out here.
We bought this acreage from a neighbor.
This is so pretty.
Canadian thistle. I don't know if you know what a Canadian thistle is, man. Yeah. Higher than my head in this area. And we walked down here. It was like 20 below zero that day. Mm-hmm. I want to build a house here. And I thought, oh, build a house here. Well, we did. We went and seen who owned it. He said, 300 foot on each side we bought.
That's
300
foot. He said, you have to take it straight across,
so
which was fair.
We got about 4 acres.
This is it's so pretty. You did very well.
You did
for a guy that can't read very fast. You did pretty darn well.
You jumped with both feet in there, didn't you, Paul?
You don't always
you jumped in with both feet.
That's right. So you grew up. You farmed growing up, and then what age did you enlist in the Army?
18.
So you went to the recruiter's office and enlisted.
Yeah, I went to Cedar Rapids, and then my birthday I got 29, 28, the two dates. Of course, I got them mixed up, and then they just about wanted to kick me out. I had just two sisters with me, so they had to verify my age. See, 28 and 29, I got them mixed up. And they said, well, I was too young if I was born in 29, but I wasn't born. I was born in 28. My birthday's 29.
Oh, yeah.
And
so you were born
the
29th in 1928.
Yeah.
Okay.
March. My birthday's in March.
March 29th, 1928.
Yeah.
And did you even have a birth certificate at that point?
Yeah.
They did. Okay.
But I don't know if I had it with me there or not. I don't think I did.
So they accepted you in, and what did they tell you? They said, hey, you're going to go into, did they give you any choice as to where you went, or they just
not
brought you?
Not too much. I was going to go in the Marines at first, and I was just about 5'6".
Okay.
Not quite. And they said, well, I should have been about a half inch taller. And
crazy.
So they wouldn't take me in the Marines. Well, I could have probably got in the limited service Marines or something. But I made it. As far as them climbing over them fences and that, man, I could did that. I was all muscles off the farm and that. And the hikes, 20-mile hikes, that was nothing for me. I could have walked all day.
So when you joined and when you enlisted, where did they send you at that point?
Well, first I went to, I think, Des Moines, I think. And then they put us on a train to go to Minnesota. The guy asked me on the train, where are you from? I said, Iowa. The damn fool, everybody was from Iowa. Where are you from? Iowa. I remember that. I was from Oxford Junction. We went to Cedar Rapids. Then we took what they called a milk train.
Okay.
They'd stop on the way. The milk train went about 20 miles an hour. And they'd stop on the way and pick up farmer's milk.
I see.
And deliver it. They call it a milk train.
Hmm.
They don't have that today. Went to Minnesota, and then from Minnesota we was there and they had a dance. They got all the young girls to come to the dance to dance with us. We had a dance there at Minnesota and slept overnight, and then the next day they shipped us to Chicago where we got our clothes, and we was there, I don't know, a week or so, not doing much, going out in the street picking up cigarette butts. And
yeah, all the stuff that privates do
and
in
other
the Army.
Stuff. But then we was getting our uniform and stuff there at Chicago. Then they shipped us from there to Louisiana.
Okay.
Took our basic training in Shreveport.
Camp Polk.
Yeah, Louisiana. So we was there, and then...
What time of the year was that, roughly? Was it in the summertime? Because I think it's pretty hot there in the summertime.
It was much... Now, that I can't tell you.
No, I was just curious.
I don't... See, I enlisted, I joined up, it'd be a September, I think 20,
I see. Okay.
Middle of September is when I joined. But then, I don't know.
So that would have been during the winter, probably, which is good.
Well, toward the fall, colder, see, yep. Started September.
Yep.
So.
And how was basic training?
It was all right. But then they gave them shots, and then, of course, you had your big field pack, and I got infection in my shoulder.
Oh, wow.
It just swelled up that big, my arm did.
And then they had to put that field pack on and stuff, so they ended up in the hospital. And that's when they had the rifle range to shoot. So then they, when I got back to the barracks, the guy said, now you want to stay with your outfit or do you want to stay here and finish out your basic training, you know, start over again? I said, well, I want to stay with my buddies. So I didn't get to shoot the range to practice, you know, for sharpshooters or that. So I was missed out on that to get them extra medals.
Sure.
But I lived through it. So.
Well, and so how basic training was probably what, like 12 weeks or something like that back then, maybe?
I think I don't remember, but it was a
something
while.
Something like that, yeah.
We had most of our basic training in Louisiana.
Okay. And where did you go after Louisiana?
Well, I think I come home, pick corn. They give us 30 days. Pick corn, worked every day home on the farm, and then went back to California. And of course, I was worried. So I got there a day ahead of time, California, which a lot of guys come 2 days after they were supposed to, and they didn't do nothing to them either. So I could have just as well stayed home a little longer. But then from California, we was there about a week or so. Mm-hmm. Then from there, they shipped us, put us on a boat. And the roughest water in the world is about a mile out from California. We hit that, and the boat would go up and the air would get in, and then the boat would hit, and they go, poosh, poosh, the boat would go up and down every day. And the toilets were up in the front of the ship. They had like 15, 20 toilets all up in the, way up in the front. And I went to the first one right inside the door, because that didn't smell so bad. You go back, everybody's puking up all over the place.
But you didn't get sick, you said.
No, I didn't get sick.
Which is interesting because you grew up in Iowa, so yeah. It's not like you were on the coast sailing. That's interesting. Very few people that I've ever talked to didn't get sick.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
But
then it took us a month to get over there to Japan first. Then we was there a couple, 3-4 days in Japan. Then they shipped us to Okinawa. We was there a while. Then they shipped us to the Philippines. I thought, I'd like to have been at Okinawa. Of course, there was dead tanks. There's tanks with steel that thick, bullet hole that big right through the side of that steel. And I should have took pictures of it. But then I took a lot of pictures, and then I went to the hospital, and somebody stole them all.
Oh, jeez.
So, but...
Tell them about Ernie Pyle.
I lost my chain of thought. Yeah, we moved him. He was the first newspaper man that got shot.
I know Ernie Pyle very
well. In the
well.
Pacific.
He was...
We moved him, but they didn't want him. Well, we moved a lot of the... I was with Graves Registration under the quartermaster.
Okay.
What they called. But we was handling the dead guys, and they was redoing them and shipping them back to the United States.
So... When did you know you were going to be doing that? Did they tell you that in the United States?
No.
You didn't find out until you got over there.
I figured they took a farm boy. So I was from the farm. They figured they could handle the dead guys.
Tough.
All right.
So do you remember the name of the ship? We just looked at it, and I don't remember.
The Brewster, I think.
The Brewster. Okay. So you took the Brewster over, and you said you landed in Okinawa?
Later. Okay. We went to... Japan first.
Okay.
Then to Okinawa just for a few days. Then from there, we went to the Philippines.
I see.
We was in the Philippines. And, I'd like to have been. Well, then they shipped us back to Okinawa, where then I stayed for over a year.
And that's where you were doing all of the grave.
But then they gave me a duck, if you know what a duck is.
I do know.
Six-wheel drive.
Amphibious vehicle.
And your controls are all on it. You can control the air in any tire from right sitting in the seat. And... they gave me that to pick up the dead guys and move them to, we reburied a lot of them on Okinawa. They put temporary, because they couldn't process them all fast enough. So they'd line them up, the dead guys, then they'd dump dirt on them. Then they'd make another line and put them in there just temporary. So then they redig them, process them to ship them back to the United States. So, but then they gave me that duck, and I'd take the bodies out to the ship because the ship couldn't come to land because the ocean wasn't deep enough. It was coral rock there. Mm-hmm. So I'd take the duck and take the dead bodies out to the big ship out in the ocean. But But then the damn thing would quit on me, and you couldn't work underneath it because there's water under you. You had to work from everything up above. So you
started doing the grave registration stuff once you got back to Okinawa,
yeah,
basically.
Pretty much.
And so they were coming up and were still finding bodies?
Yeah. A lot of them, up in the hills.
Yeah.
The people that farm there, the natives, the Japanese, well, the airplane landed here in my back field. So then the wife and the man would go out there, and they'd had a spade. They'd dig a little hole, and they took the bodies, laid them in the hole, and covered them up. And then we'd come there. We knew an airplane landed there someplace. Mm-hmm. We'd find it, and then the Japanese people would take us to where it was and showed us that they buried the people here. So then we'd redig them and package them up and ship them back. So the ones that was up in the hills were pretty well rotted already. But the ones that was closer to the ocean, they were just like the day they were shot.
Yeah, the water.
Because the salt water.
It's kind of preserved them. So then we put them in. We had wooden boxes, plywood, with four bolts. Bolts were that long that come up through the box to tie the lid on the box.
Tell them about the whiskers and stuff and just have a hole.
Oh, they looked. A young boy, good-looking lad, laying there, and, of course, whiskers about like I got now.
But he said they were pretty well preserved.
Yeah, the ones that were near the ocean, they was like they were shot. Good-looking boy with, you can see some hair in his chest and a bullet hole right through his chest. I remember that. Then we had an airplane wreck there that burned and brought him there in the morgue. They had we had a couple of natives help get the bodies ready. And then, of course, we had our American doctors that did the work the body over to ship. And here
the embalming.
They cut the guy open, and he was laying there with the guts out, and they took the stomach out, and they had a big bucket there. They cleaned the stomach out, put everything clean, all the insides, cleaned them all up, threw them back in and threw some powder, that embalming powder, on there and put him in the box, and they shipped him to the United States.
Wow. So they were cleaning out all the bacteria whatever.
Well, they didn't want to ship all that weight and that rotten stuff, so they just put the body. But this airplane wreck, they brought this guy in there, and he was burnt pretty bad. And the only thing was good is his feet. He had them big combat boots on, and of course, when he burnt, his feet didn't get affected. Hmm. They put the fire out before the leather on the boots burned up. He's laying there all burned up, a body, and his feet looked just like brand new.
That's crazy.
I can remember that.
Did any of that bother you, or were you just... No. You were just...
He was a farm boy.
You were used tough. To... You've seen everything on the farm.
Oh, yeah.
That's... And so how many bodies do you... if you had to guess?
Oh, a couple thousand.
Thousands.
Well, yeah, you've seen the cemeteries.
Yeah.
So...
And you were there... You were on Okinawa probably like a year after the battle or something like that. So they're still recovering all those bodies on a regular basis. And then you said you would bury them temporarily.
Yeah.
And then if the families wanted them to go home, then you would dig them up and ship them home.
Well, they did. They shipped them anyway if they wanted them or not.
Okay.
They'd ship them either to the, like Ernie Pyle. The family didn't. They buried him on...
the island, you said?
The Philippines, I think. National Cemetery in the Philippines. So
regardless, you'd get them out of Okinawa, and then the family would figure out where to... How hard... What did you ever get into trying to figure out the identities at all?
That wasn't nothing to do with me. But the damn kids, when they went into battle, they throw all their dog tags in a pile, and they pick up any... They didn't have their dog tags, so you couldn't go by the dog. You had to go by their hair, how tall they are, and their teeth. That was the main thing. The boy I went in with, they made him a corporal right away because he had some medical school ahead of time, and he'd take care of the teeth, figure all the teeth out, what they had. That's how they identified him, mostly by the fillings in their teeth.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they still have hundreds of thousands of bodies that are unidentified today. They still have that
in the United States.
In the United States, there's an entire department today that it's several hundred soldiers that are dedicated to nothing more than identifying remains from as far back as World War II.
Yeah.
And every year the DNA technology gets better.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And so every year they're able to identify more and more.
Yeah.
And we're the only country in the world that does that.
Yeah.
No.
Every other country in the world just puts them in a grave and says they're unknown soldier or whatever. But we're the only country in the world that actually takes the time to
figure out.
Yeah. Well, to get them back their
Our outfit hated to run into a Jap body. Because they said they had more problem to process the Jap body and get rid of it. So they had them big caves on Okinawa, and at night, we weren't supposed to, but somebody would get a key to the warehouse and go in and get a lantern, and we'd light the lantern at midnight. We'd take that lantern with us. We went down in the caves.
Yeah,
dead bodies all over the place.
Oh, that's something I wanted.
And barrels. They had barrels. They had water in for drinking and stuff. When the Japs lived in them caves, see?
They were holding out the...
Well, what we did with the flamethrowers, they stood at the entrance and blowed a lot of flames in the cave. Mm-hmm. Well, they ate up with oxygen, and the Japs died in the caves, see? But then they just left them there because it was more process, more work getting them processed. So they left the Jap body just lay there. We'd walk down in the caves over the dead bodies and stuff to see them. Then I brought back a flag. And, of course, then I ended up in the hospital, and somebody stole my flag, Jap flag I had, and some other stuff. And
so what'd you do with the Jap bodies? Nothing?
Well, they processed them.
Okay.
But like I said, they had more problems with them trying to process them, get them out than they did. The Americans, so they really hated it. I did more of the labor. I didn't too much with the process. And they had, where the undertaker worked, it was American. And then we had a couple of natives that was helping out. Like I said, they cut the body open and clean the insides all up, throw them back in, throw the guts back in the body. And I don't think they even sewed them back up. And just lay them.
Embalm them and send them off.
But they embalmed them different than they do like today. So.
And you were just working to do anything. You'd ship, take the bodies back and forth to the ships and to anything necessary to help prepare the...
I was like a labor worker. Well, I should have had really four stripes, but they ended up giving me two. And we can't give you any more because the outfit needs... You're allowed like 100 stripes, and we got 100 stripes. They can't have any more. So
never got promoted.
I just ended up. Then they wanted to reenlist me and give me a stripe, and I went home to farm.
and you had to take care of the generators too.
Yeah, that was on Okinawa when we was for our electricity. We had two great big diesel generators, about that wide and higher than my head. If you know what I
do.
Well, bigger than they were, like I said, they were that wide, high as my head, maybe 10 foot long. We had two of them, but I'd lay down, we had nice dirt in between them, and I'd lay down there and take a nap. And if one of them quit, I could wake up right away. Mm. The officers, they took our, we had a nice building that they after the war, it was fixed up, and they had their, like a clubhouse. Well, the damn officers took it away from the enlisted men, say. But then they had a big party one night, and here the generators went out. And I wanted a, like, brown nose or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
To the officers, see. I tried to get that damn generator going. Well, here found out the shaft that fed the fuel twisted off.
Oh, I see.
Well, I couldn't get the damn thing going because it couldn't get no fuel.
Yeah.
But so I didn't get the brown nose, the officers. I thought maybe help me get some stripes.
Yeah, help you get promoted. Do you remember any other? I know you mentioned a couple specific bodies that you've dealt with. Do you remember any others that stick out in your mind for whatever reason?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, I always wondered when you're responsible for doing anything like that, how much you actually let yourself, you know, pay attention to who it is that you're handling or if it's just a job.
Well, they didn't want us to take any pictures, which I did. Yeah. I had a camera and I snuck pictures, but then I lost them after I went to the hospital.
They stole them from me.
But yeah. I keep my camera hidden under the seat in there. But so I don't know what I was going to say.
Did you know any of them?
No, no. But see, that's why they didn't want pictures, because I'd go back home and say, hey, I got a picture of Joe here, $50. Yeah. You want a picture of your son?
Yeah.
And they against the law.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's just you're the first person I've ever met that you know, did that. And and that's just, it's a very, very important, huge responsibility.
Yeah.
But to think about all the, you know, stories of all those soldiers that you sent them home, you know, it's just amazing to think about all.
Well, they put them temporary there in Okinawa. We reburied a lot of them till they could get to them to process them to ship them home. But we made crosses about as white as boards like that, made a cross and painted them white and put crosses out there after they were there, like maybe 6 months or a while till they could get to them. But I thought it was kind of silly putting all them cross. Well, you got pictures of there.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot of that.
And so they would bury them again just to preserve them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Okinawa, they had a cemetery where every beach end was.
Oh, I see.
And I think they had about every, they called them different names where there's a lot of sand. Each beach had a different name, of course. And wherever beachhead was, they killed a lot of guys. Well, they had a cemetery there. Instead of moving the bodies over to that other cemetery, they'd just make a cemetery.
I see.
There was about like six or seven cemeteries there on that little town, little island of Okinawa.
Was that Americans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that was an incredibly bloody.
Well, they killed so many people. Yeah. The soldiers would go up, like 20 of them would go up and they'd shoot half of them. And they'd lay there.
Yeah, those beachheads were just.
A lot of times I thought, well, they didn't have to do that. They got to just sit out there with a ship, watch no food goes in, and the people would die of starvation. but they didn't.
They weren't patient enough for that.
Yeah, they went in there and then they got half of them got killed going there to get them. So, yeah.
That was a brutal, brutal battle.
Yeah.
You've seen the effects of it better than anybody because you've seen all the deaths.
So.
Because you think about every single one of those men or soldiers or Marines that you processed, you know, went home to a family.
Yeah.
And, you know, the gratitude that those families, even though you never got to meet them, the gratitude that those families had for all the work that you and your guys did to send them home was.
But they didn't allow us to take, they didn't want us to take pictures because, like I said, you'd go blackmail them with the pictures afterwards and stuff. So we never got to write down any names. But like I said, I took pictures.
Yeah.
And illegally. Yeah. But then I lost them all when I ended up in the hospital. And then I had a Jap flag. I had it, of course, under my bed. And when I went to the hospital, I took all my pictures and the Jap flag and all.
These are his buddies.
All the good stuff. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did that.
So.
We had a similar deal when I was in Iraq. I don't know if you remember, there was a period of time where they were beheading all these guys on the internet. You know, these terrorists were beheading all of them.
I remember seeing that.
And we would find most of those guys in our area, you know, and a lot of them were Americans. They were contractors, you know, they were different people. And so we'd take pictures, of course, to document everything. And as soon as we'd go back to the base, they'd come down and try to, you know, take all the pictures. Yeah, they would behead these guys and then hang them from the bridge or hang them from wherever. And they would, sometimes they would booby trap them.
Yeah.
So you go up to the body and there would be an explosive, you know, bomb or whatever, you know, that's just terrible. Brutal. But same deal. They would come take all the pictures. And then whenever a U.S. soldier would die or was killed, they would cut all phone communication.
Yeah.
Or internet until the family was notified. Oh, the entire base would be shut down. So there was no communication back to the, because they didn't want, you know,
yeah,
so-and-so calling their wife and saying, hey, you know, we lost Sergeant so-and-so, and then have his family find out about it before the chaplain could go notify him.
Yeah.
You know, but they do, the United States spends more money and goes to more lengths to treat these, the fallen properly than any other nation in the world, which is why you were over there doing what you were doing. So you were there for about a year in Okinawa?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then after you left Okinawa, did you come back home after that or?
Yeah, they shipped me. Well, I was crippled. I got my back hurt. And then from there I went, I didn't have to do no work on the boat because I could, you know, act like
you
I
got was hurt
more,
over there.
I was more sick than I was really that way. But from there they shipped me to Washington, the state of Washington. Tacoma, I think there was two hospitals there, and I was in both of them. There's pictures here of the both hospitals up there. Then when we got to go home, well, I couldn't walk, and so they gave me a wheelchair. Well, I couldn't push the wheelchair because that really hurt my back. So they gave me a pair of crutches. I could walk with the crutches because the crutches were under my arm, and I could get. Then they shipped me home the next day with the crutches. And I couldn't even walk hardly. And another guy was going the same way. He had a car. So I drove with him from Washington. We drove to, I think, Des Moines or someplace. And then from there, I took a bus home. And I remember the bus, I fell asleep. And they were supposed to let me off at Wyoming, Iowa. and instead, I woke up. We was about 5 miles from Wyoming. And the next town was Monmouth. I don't know if you know where Monmouth is.
I've heard of it. Yeah, I've heard of it.
It's on 64.
I've heard of it.
Well, I got off then at Monmouth with my big duffel bag, which weighed over 100 pounds with all my clothes, extra pair of big shoes in there. And I carried that like 5 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
Our home, we lived about 6-7 miles south of Monmouth.
Yeah.
And that's where our home was. I carried that just about all the way home.
Oh, my gosh.
From Monmouth. Then I wanted to get off at Wyoming, and then I could hitchhike. More traffic on that main road. I could
have told what you did.
Got a ride to Oxford Junction. Then from there, I could have called somebody to come and said what I did what.
You fell asleep is the reason you didn't get
off.
Yeah,
I fell asleep on the bus. Instead of getting off at Wyoming, the bus went, of course, right.
That's
through.
Okay. At least you didn't miss it too much.
Yeah. You didn't end up in some other state.
Yeah, they took me to Macoken.
How did you hurt your back?
I don't know. Just
from all the lifting and everything.
Then I got that bone disease.
Yeah.
And I shrunk 8 inches.
Wow.
Now, and I don't know if I'm still shrinking or not, but when my pants keep going shorter and shorter, you think, but hey, he's getting shorter all the time, but didn't pay attention. I used to wear 29, 29. That's pretty little, 29. That's 29, 29. And now it's about 36.
And how long?
24 is all my pant leg. 20. Wow. I used to have 29.
He was taller than me.
Well, you know, it's normal to shrink a little bit as you get older. If you grew 8 inches, we would wonder.
Yeah.
If you grew 8 inches, that would
vitamins.
Be.
Good vitamins.
Well, reaching the cupboards or stuff. I mean, I can't reach up there.
Yeah. He can't. He has to get in a funny position to go up or to go down.
I gotta get a ladder on.
So came back. Eventually, your back felt a little better, and you went to work on the farm.
Yeah.
Went to work on
the
farm.
Well, I had back trouble at farming too, but I had a John Deere with a hand clutch. I'd get on that, and my back would hurt, but I'd stand it up. I stand up better driving the John Deere and shake and shook. But then if pig would get out or something, I'd try to go catch a pig and I could hardly walk and stuff like that.
Out of curiosity, you've gone to the VA, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the VA is paying you some disability for your back? Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that mm-hmm. was the case.
Well, then they try to cure it with radiation.
Yeah.
And then they cooked me. They put that radiation shots each. They give me like 5 or 6 shots on my back, and each shot over a minute of solid radiation. And they just cooked me. Then when I got married, we couldn't have no kids for like over five years.
Wow.
Because the radiation killed everything.
Right.
But
you're doing pretty good. Look where we live.
Yeah. You get it all worked out. It all worked out just fine. And then how long after you got back did the two of you get married?
My graduation.
younger, well, not too much younger. I was probably 17 years old or 16. My oldest brother would go to pick up his wife, his girlfriend, LaVon. My oldest brother was Raymond. There's a picture of him.
And LaVon was my first cousin.
Well, he'd go there, and of course, I wanted to go. A lot of times, he would take me along, see? And one day that, well, he had a farm rented right there where we lived. And so she's, her folks lived on a farm, and he'd go see her, of course. And he wanted some cats. They had a lot of cats. So he wanted to, you should always have a couple of cats on the farm to take care of the mice, see? So this night he took a 5 or 6 gunny sacks with him. Well, we're going to go pick up some cats tonight from her farm. So, of course, I went along. He picks up the cats, see?
Yeah.
Puts them in the car, and then he goes to the movie or something with her.
It was a dance.
Something. Anyway, they're out all night, see? And I'm there in the car sleeping with all these cats going to the toilet. And, oh, I'm telling you, that was terrible.
Oh, my gosh.
Them cats in them gunny sacks, and, of course, gunny sacks don't hold no...
Right.
No
right.
manure.
Moisture.
And it was terrible. Me in the back seat, like I said, with about 4 or 5 gunny sacks, with each sack had 2 or 3 cats in them.
Oh, my gosh. And then you sold your farm?
Later, after we quit farming. But I farmed.
What age did you sell your farm? Roughly.
I don't know, 65.
Okay, that's cool. That's a long time.
There's a sale bill here.
No, I know you showed it to me.
Because that's when you...
84, we had the
84, yeah.
And that's why you built the house up here, and you sold down there and got done farming.
Yeah.
And you sold.
But we didn't sell both farms. We just sold one.
Yeah.
We still got the one farm.
We paid for the first farm in 7 years, which is very unusual. Well, we stayed home. She had all the furniture and stuff for the house.
Yeah, I had a good job. I worked at Clinton Foods, I bought all my own furniture.
And of course,
I was going to have more than what my mother.
But we had trouble farming.
We were very poor.
We got what they call the baby pig disease, and then we got the greasy pig disease. Pigs that are half grown, like 100. We usually raised them up to 220 or so, 240. Now they raise them, I think, up to 300.
Okay.
I think. But we try to sell. The pigs are about 100 years old, or 100 years old, 100 pounds.
Yeah.
The pigs are about, we got this baby pig disease, greasy pig. You get a hold of the pig leg and, it's just like, you couldn't hold them. Yeah. It was all, we lost so many pigs. I mean, if I'd been a millionaire if I could have kept up. The stuff that
and it started lost. Spreading and everything.
Lost all the pigs. Then we lost a few cows. Of course, you always lose some. But I had one cow that got hurt. I don't know. Having a calf, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They hurt the hind end. She breaks a vessel or something in there, and then she couldn't walk. So then I tied her legs together with a string loose so it wouldn't hurt her. So she could walk some. But I couldn't get her home, so I took 4 gates and made a pen out in the field where she was, and then I'd have a bucket of water there, and I'd feed her every day. And here she got pretty good shape to go. So I took her to the sale barn, and they cracked the whips, and it sounded like a bullet going off, snap, snap. Well, they scared the poor cow, and she got in the rain to be sold, and, of course, they cracked the whip, and she moved, and she went down, of course, and then... They had to give her away for nothing. So, I mean, she was crippled, see?
Yeah.
But I could have butchered. She was in good shape. I could have butchered her for a hamburger or something.
Yeah.
Because I was taking care of her. But when they cracked them whips, I didn't like that. It sounded like a bullet going off.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but.
So you did cattle, pigs?
Chickens,
everything.
Yeah, we bought the farm with a lot of chickens on it. The guy had eggs. We had eggs. She'd have to stay in the basement cleaning eggs. The chickens sometimes had dirt, go to the toilet in the nest. Then the eggs get dirty. And she was cleaning eggs for several hours every day. Because we was getting a lot of, we had over maybe 200-300 chickens. When I bought the farm, I bought the chickens with the farm. They had 2 great big chicken houses. Like
big as two of these rooms together.
That's amazing.
I don't know if I had pictures there or not.
What an operation. That's how big was your farm, your big farm?
The first farm we had was 120.
That's a lot of land.
And then I bought it. Then I bought another 100. I ended up with, I think, 300 acres. My dad's farm, which I hated. I had a farm at one other kid. I hated. They had a farm sale and started an auction. Another story I'll tell them. She heard it 10 times. She's tired of it. Well, they had the farm sale, see, and auctioning it. Well, we had two farms, Dad. We had the 120, and then he bought a, it was supposed to be 300, ended up with 300 acres. So, see, I'm confused a little bit, but anyway, when Dad sold out, the farm bill is here. He had two farms. So they sold the one farm, which was close. My oldest brother, he bid on it. It went for like $250 an acre, something like that. Then the next, my older sister kept poking the neighbor because she'd get a commission, see, the money be divided up in the family, whatever I bought the farm for. See. And so anyway, they come to this other farm to sell. And of course, I'm bidding on it. Seeing my oldest sister is poking this guy by Art Becker. You bid on it. Art Becker wanted it, kind of, see. But he wouldn't bid against me. So they started. It was a pretty good farm. I mean, hilly-roly. But they got it like 300. And I, come on, somebody bid. And nobody bid 300. They come down to 250. Nobody bid. And that Eddie Sturck, I can still remember. He was an old neighbor of ours. Mm-hmm. He was standing by me. He said, Paul, wait, Paul. So he saved me several thousand dollars. They got down to $175 an acre. And I said, well, come on, let's go sell it. Nobody would raise me. I bought the damn farm for $175 an acre.
Isn't that wonderful?
Amazing.
My first
and now
farm.
It's probably 11,000 or more an acre.
Yeah.
I bought
amazing.
The first farm. And we paid for it in, like I said, seven years. And then I bought the, then Dad was selling his farm.
That is amazing. Well, I was going to ask you, I always like to ask veterans like yourself, but what, if any, and for both of you, what advice would you have for kids that are growing up today that are just getting started, maybe going in the military for the first time or just growing up?
Boy.
What advice would you give them?
Well, if they go, what I'd say is to listen to the boss, the main thing, and try not to, he's the boss, but we got a relation that tries to tell the boss how to do it. We got one girl related to us, that Melissa.
Oh, our granddaughter.
Yeah, she wants to tell the
she
boss.
She wants to tell the boss what to do, and that don't work.
But that's this,
very, very that's smart.
This generation,
she's a
that's
prodigy
what
prodigy child.
Yeah, yeah.
But
she
that's
was.
What they want to do these days. They want to be the.
Yeah.
They want to tell the
and
boss how to do it.
And they'll get in trouble in every job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Listen to the boss and abide by.
I will say she's doing better at that today.
Good.
So, I guess she was fired too many times.
She's learning. She's learning.
Yeah.
They're
very, very intelligent. And she knows they're not doing it right.
I know. That's gets her intelligence gets her in trouble.
Yeah, her intelligence gets her in trouble.
What advice would you have to youngsters growing up today?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. You have to be very patient sometimes.
Patience is important.
They're growing up in a not too good situation.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's hard being the challenge is that you all have done all the hard work.
Yeah.
You know, and you delivered this country.
It don't come easy.
I know. And the sacrifice that you had growing up, growing up during the Great Depression, and then
and my mother died when I was 16.
Wow.
I became the lady of the house.
Wow.
For my two brothers.
At age 16.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the level of responsibility that you both carried at a very young age, mm-hmm. kids these days don't carry that responsibility until they're 40 or 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very common for children, kids to live with their parents for many, many, many many years.
Yes.
And
we're still helping some of ours.
That's
older girl is a lawyer, so she's doing really good. But Barbara married Charlie Souza, a musician.
Yeah, I see.
And they live in Florida.
Oh, I see. Gotcha. I see.
That he's the musician.
I see.
Charlie Souza. Yep. I don't know. Maybe you heard of him.
I have not, but I'm not the most musically inclined person.
Great, great, great grandfather wrote the Star Spangled Banner. It was a Souza.
Ah, okay.
So he has a famous man in his back.
I can remember that name from high school, that Souza.
Yeah.
She
married a famous musician, poor musician.
Yeah.
And they live in Florida. Both girls do. One on one coast and one on the other coast.
My mom and my grandparents, I told you they grew up in Clinton, and then they moved to Florida at some point.
Oh.
They moved to Florida. And so I was born in Florida.
Oh, so what part of Florida?
Sarasota. Sarasota.
Oh.
On the West Coast.
On the West Coast.
On the West Coast. And like I said, I've only been to Iowa a few times, this being one of them.
Oh.
But and by the way, they played that Field of Dreams game last year. I watched that. How far is that from here?
From here, it's probably about maybe 40 miles.
Oh, that's...
Just up at Dyersville.
That's not far at all.
Three miles out. I was just there yesterday.
That's not far at all.
It's a famous place.
I know it is. Yeah. I know it. I watched the game.
And when he first got acquainted with my daughter, that was where he wanted to go, to Dyersville.
Dyersville. That's
and they have 1,000 people every day come there.
To
you go through the house, the barns, play on the field. Yeah. Mm. Every day, 1,000 people, and you just give a donation.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I so appreciate your time and telling me these stories and showing us these pictures, and it's just simply amazing seeing how you grew up and what you did and all that. Both of you, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I was the lady of the house at 16.
Yeah, what they had to go through.
High school.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And we had no buses until my junior year.
And you had a great job.
Yeah.
You had a great job.
Yeah.
Clinton Foods.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I just.
Yeah, I have to thank Clinton Foods because they were good.
They
were very good people to work for. And I was very lucky.
Was it common at that time for women to have such good jobs? Was it because
Well, everybody that worked at Clinton Foods had a good job.
It was secretarial.
Like, I did the billing work for all the boxcars that went out.
I see.
That way.
And
it was in manual labor.
I never sent one to the wrong place.
That's perfect. That's wonderful.
Because you had to make sure you double check those.
Well, there's towns that are two towns in two different states. You got to get the right state.
Or they take the boxcar to the wrong place.
Have you ever traveled back to Europe or to Asia after the war?
No.
In the rest of your life?
No,
you never even went to the...
I went.
Did you go see the...
New York. Or Washington,
To Washington to see the
flight. Yeah, did you go on the flights to Washington to see the
memorial?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, Paul.
One of the first
WMT
ones.
Sponsored it for 1 year.
Yeah.
What was your favorite monument or memorial?
I don't know.
There's so many of them.
There's so many of them.
Yeah,
they got some of them. They got the soldier like standing there made out of cement and that.
Yeah,
did you go by yourself? Or do you
they had a whole car load, an airplane load.
But usually you took somebody with you.
I think
apparently you didn't take June.
No. Another soldier. I don't know if it was Herman or who went with me. There was another.
I went with you one time.
Yeah, but not on the, what they call the freedom flight.
No.
You
and Herman went.
Is it Herman? Could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great program that they have, and you guys deserve. I mean, you guys built that whole, all of your stuff that's happened in your lifetime, built all of those memorials. And that concludes episode 27, which is our interview with Paul and June Benischek. Just want to thank them both so much for joining us. It was really fun having June there because one, she
tells some amazing stories as well. And two, she stays on top of Paul to make sure he remembers everything and tells his stories. And they just have an amazing home. And I always thought of Iowa, I didn't spend much time in Iowa, even though my family's from there, but I always thought Iowa was very flat, like flat farmland. And from their house and their farm, it's really hilly. They have just spectacular views from their house. Just really, really amazing. Just never thought of Iowa as being that hilly and having those types of views. So really nice to see them, to meet them, to check out their amazing home, and just an amazing couple. And, you know, June and Paul both, but in particular June, she still does all of their landscaping, the flower beds, gardening. They have an amazing garden. You know, she does all of that at age 91. Just amazing. You know, our greatest generation. We call them that for a reason, and they're continuing to do positive things and to produce and to be productive members of society. They're just, they inspire me every single day. And then also want to thank again, Barb and Denny and Rob for arranging all this and setting this up and hosting me. Just had an amazing day and want to thank them for setting all that up. And I can't wait to go back and see them. And then just reflecting a little bit on what Paul said and Paul's story. You think when I first heard about Paul, in my mind, I thought, wow, I mean, talk about some serious PTSD that he would have from handling all these bodies and literally processing thousands of bodies to the point that he was dealing with, you know, opening them up and sewing them and back up and burying them and reburying them and sending them home. Just very, very difficult job. And so one would think there'd be a tremendous PTSD that goes along with that. But I was talking to Denny actually afterwards, after we met Paul in June, and, you know, we were kind of mulling over that point. And Denny said, you know what? Yes, he handled a lot of bodies, but he didn't know them personally. You know, he didn't have those relationships with them personally. So to him, it was a job, and, you know, they were just bodies. They weren't, you know, brothers that he knew their ins and outs and their family stories and things of that nature. And so, you know, that got me thinking a little bit, like, to my military service and actually just sitting here talking to my friend Mike Tarr about this, and we were going through it and talking about how, you know, when we were deployed in combat zones, we saw dead bodies all the time. You know, it was common, almost a daily occurrence, you would see dead bodies, and really kind of just got used to it. It wasn't until you lost one of your own brothers that it really bothered you. And I think that's the case here with Paul as well, is that he dealt with these every single day, and it just, because they were numbers, it didn't bother him. And he didn't have the same relationships with them, because he told me he suffers from no PTSD, doesn't think about it. He said he's seen worse stuff on the farm. So really just an amazing perspective, but it really does make sense. Like when I look at my own service and talk through this with other service members, it really makes a lot of sense. So again, really want to thank Paul and June for taking the time to do this. It's a very interesting perspective, something we never looked at on the podcast before. And it's a difficult topic because you're talking about the fallen, but it's also very real and something that was addressed. And of course, with the millions and millions and millions of lost lives, you know, during World War II, it was a very significant part of the operation and what had to happen, you know, during the war, after the war, and just very significant. So I want to thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to follow along, you can go to our website, www.walkamongheroes.org. There's some videos, unique content on there. We're also on YouTube, search Walk Among Heroes. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/walkamongheroes, or you can go to Instagram, @walkamongheroes. We support an organization called Wish for Our Heroes. The organization assists military families with basic needs. It's a 501c3 run by volunteers. Find out more information at www.wishforourheroes.org. We always want to thank those who are protecting our way of life every single day, the police, the firefighters, all those on the front lines here domestically, protecting our way of life. And then, of course, all of our incredible military members that are stationed abroad around the world in places we don't even know about, that are protecting our way of life. And our heart goes out to those who lost loved ones in Afghanistan. Our heart goes out to those that are still in Afghanistan today trying to get out. And we hope and pray that they'll make it back to this great country safely. I want to thank those in the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, Space Force, Coast Guard. want to thank all of you for serving our nation, for sacrificing so much for all of us and allowing us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, which is freedom. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Walk Among Heroes, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks.